Well, greetings, and welcome to Caribbean Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network, where we expand our ability to communicate and unite the struggles of African people towards victory and independence in our lifetime. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and here on the Forum, we examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. We bring you news, views, interviews, thought-provoking discussions, Caribbean theater of the mind, and of course, musical interludes. Well, today is very special on the African continent and the world at large, as today South Sudanese citizens and the new world's newest president, Salva Kiir, convened in the new country capital of Juba, the birth of a nation. South and North Sudan battled two civil wars for more than five decades. Culminating in a 2005 peace deal that led to today's independence celebration. Congratulations to the citizens of South Sudan, which now becomes Africa's 54th state. Oh, well, the West Indies cricket team is about to start day four of the third test match, against India, which is being played in Roseau in Dominica. As at the end of day yesterday, the West Indies were 210 for 10 and India on 308 for the loss of six wickets. Over the last 10 years or so, the West Indies team and organization have not been living up to the expectation of many cricket fans around the world. But today we'll share with you Fire in Babylon. It's a cricket documentary produced and directed by Stephen Riley, bringing back memories of the good old days of cricket when the West Indies reigned supreme. It features greats which include Viv Richards, Clive Lloyd, Gordon Greenidge, Derek Murray, Colin Croft, Michael Holding, Desmond Haynes, Andy Roberts, and a special guest appearance by Bunny Wailer of Bob Marley and the Wailers. We'll chat with the CEO of News America, Felicia Passad. She'll bring us up to date with news affecting the Caribbean and the diaspora. So tell someone that Caribbean Forum is on the air for the next 2 hours here on the Uhuru Radio Network. Well, now that South Sudan is the newest nation, the slogan adopted by the African Union is simple. Africa must unite. But one of the questions being asked is, will the independence of South Sudan force governments to pay greater attention to the concerns and grievances of marginalized areas? Here is Bob Marley, Africa, Unite.
Africa, unite, 'cause we're moving right out of Babylon, and we're going to our father's land. Yeah. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man, yeah, to see the unification of all Africans. Yeah. As it's been said already, let it be done. Yeah. We are the children. Children of God.
Yes, that is Robert Nesta Marley. Robert Nesta Marley, Africa Must Unite. The South Sudan is now the newest nation, the 54th in the state of Africa. You're listening to Caribbean Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
For news, views, interviews, and thought-provoking discussions, tune in to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Temple every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time right here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
Absolutely. And joining us is that voice from that promoter. That promo is the voice of Miss Felicia Passard. Felicia, good morning and welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Top of the morning to you, Ron, and to all the listeners. I have a little cold, so I'm not sounding the same as I did on that.
I don't think you're alone, so worry not. As far as having a cold, that is. So how are you doing this morning, Felicia, other than having a cold?
I'm very good, actually. You know, once the summer is here, I'm usually the happiest person around. So that is always a good thing.
Oh, you're a summer person, huh?
Yep.
Okay. Share with us, Felicia, what's happening, in the diaspora and what's happening that's affecting Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals. News about
Let me just start out with some good news, Ron. The first good news is that a lot of people, you know, don't realize how much our Caribbean immigrants have contributed to this country. And it's very amazing because the late Bertram L. Baker was actually born in Nevis. And Nevis is going to be going into an election on Monday. But that aside, Bertram Baker became one of the first black men to be elected in Brooklyn. In fact, he was the first black politician in Brooklyn. He got elected to the state assembly, and this was in 1940s. And so Bertram Baker is actually going to have a street co-named after him in Brooklyn, and I think that is really positive news.
Where's that going to be, Felicia?
It's actually going to be on Jefferson Avenue between Tompkins and Trop, and it's going to happen on July 16th. They're actually going to put up the sign because the city council approved it late last year. So his granddaughter, who is actually the first lady of Massachusetts, Lady Diane Patrick, obviously the governor's wife, Deval Patrick, she is actually his granddaughter, and they're going to be on hand for this ceremony. So it really is a beautiful thing when you talk about Caribbean American heritage. We're just coming off of that month,
right?
And here we see history really in the making and sort of the generations that have come because of Bertram Baker and his immigrant roots in Nevis.
A lot of people do not realize that there are many Caribbean nationals, Caribbean or sons and daughters of the Caribbean, who have made significant contributions to this country and to the world at large.
Absolutely, and that is something that always offends me, especially when you get into some sort of what we call ignorant folks on the African-American side that are always quick to tell you, go back where you come from. That is something that I always find amazing, because when you trace the history, you see that people have been here since slavery. In fact, one of the slaves from Bermuda that moved here, among the many that you can trace, was a woman named Mary Prince, and she was born in Bermuda. Considered one of the first West Indian slaves to be moved to this country and to work and shed her blood in this country. So there's just so many stories like that. But I think, Ron, it's all our fault, because we as the Caribbean people, we're not doing the right thing in terms of telling our stories.
Absolutely.
And that really is something that we have to seriously revisit. We're going to sort of, you know, really change things and prove that, listen, we have made significant contributions to this country beyond just the folks that you know, Marcus Garvey and all the others. There are so many other stories that are so untold. When you go to Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty, you see these people who have come off the boat. They're all there documented. They were all coming here.
I remember Dave Martin's of the Tradewinds, he recorded that song, Where Are Our Heroes? You know, and exactly. It is so significant, you know, that you don't see like statues, you don't hear, you don't read them in history books. And it's really unfortunate because significant contributions, as I mentioned before, have been made, by folks who were born in the Caribbean and, of course, of Caribbean heritage. Now, Felicia, there seems to be concern among green card holders who have somewhat of an apprehension of becoming a naturalized citizen. Why is this? Why there seems to be this fear?
Well, I think, first of all, Ron, there is, among the immigrant community right now, there is the concern of cost. So that is a fact. Because when you apply for citizenship, it's $680 that you have to find at once to do this. And then you go through the entire process. But I think beyond that, people have this perception somehow that they're always going back home. And they want to hold on to this passport, not realizing you have dual citizenship. In fact, it's very interesting. I'll share a story. And this is a very, very smart guy. There is that big blue collar about him. He works in Wall Street, has a very top job there. And him and I had this discussion, and he said, no way, I'm not becoming an American citizen. I'm holding on to my Bajan passport. And that's why he travels on with his green card. So I said, you know, this is sort of ridiculous. Do you understand that even if you commit drunk driving now, that's like offense that can be used against you? And, you know, it really did not faze him at all. So I think these are the things that people hold on to, the sort of issue, oh, well, we're Barbadian or we're Guyanese or we're Jamaican. Well, that's fine. But you're living here, you're paying taxes, and there is always the possibility that something could happen, not just to you, but maybe to a family member that would make them deportable. And it is so important that people become citizens, because this is one of the major things. You hear so many stories. There was a story recently of a guy, and he was actually a local television producer in Brooklyn, that was born actually in Jamaica, came here as a little kid. His parents applied for citizenship but never applied for the passport for him. And recently he got into trouble with the law. He's now deportable because he cannot prove that he's a U.S. citizen because the parents just did not apply for the passport. So he is in limbo, caught up in a detention center, not even sure, you know, if Jamaica is going to accept him because he doesn't have a Jamaican passport. He doesn't have a U.S. passport, so he's in a limbo. And these are the sort of scenarios that people need to understand, especially now since the U.S. ICE is going after just about every immigrant. You don't even have to be convicted to be caught up in the deportation and detention centers, and that is the scary part for me, because under this secure program, secure initiative that they're running, once you're arrested and you're taken into custody in Rikers Island, the U.S. ICE runs the fingerprints. They see that you're an immigrant, that you may be a green card holder or not. They're coming for you and taking you into detention. Meanwhile, you haven't been convicted of a crime, but that's just how the law is rolling these days. So I think the USCIS recognizes they have to get this message out, and they are actually spending advertising dollars for the very first time in urging people to become citizens. And I think Caribbean immigrants especially need to step up to the plate and become citizens and just stop complaining about, you know, the deportation and everything that we always hear about. This is a reality check. People need to step up and also step up to vote, because 2012 is right around the corner.
That scenario you just shared with us, do you feel it's because of negligence on the part of the parents, or is it miseducation?
I think it is a little bit of both, and I think it's also because within our community there isn't really many organizations left with funding or any sort of help that continues to spread the citizenship message or do citizenship drive. When the Caribbean Immigrant Services got out of the box and they did quite a bit of these citizenship drives in the 90s, that really made a big difference. And you could tell, because there were many Caribbean politicians who eventually got elected in Brooklyn because of it, because you now created a voting bloc that you could rely on. And that is something I think our politicians need to get back on, that need to put aside funding for, and really push this education message. Because I really think it comes down to education. At the end of the day, people need to be educated on why they should become a naturalized citizen and not continue to hang on to this old facet that they continue to say, oh, well, you know, we're going back home, or we just want to keep our nationalism. Nationalism is going to stay alive and well, but if you're living in a country and paying taxes, I think you need to benefit from everything that you're giving in that country, and especially protect yourself, because you know this deportation issue, and then coming into the airports, Ron, as a green card holder, is such a nightmare. Coming back into this country is a nightmare for green card holders. Just standing in a line forever, people are just like acting like you don't even exist. It's ridiculous. So take advantage if you qualify for it, and really step up to the plate and do the right thing.
Other than that, Felicia, what are some of the other advantages of becoming a naturalized citizen, and what are the requirements and the procedure?
Well, definitely, once you become a citizen, you're able to vote. So that's a big thing I think people should be looking at, especially as we look into a presidential election. You're eligible to actually apply for federal jobs. That is a major thing, because there are many people looking for jobs currently, and the government is always finding some way to hire. So there are just so many advantages. Obviously, you no longer face the threat of deportation should you become, you know, get into any sort of trouble or into any kind of crime. So that is something I think that people need to really look at and make sure that they look at these things when they do. Obviously, you travel with a U.S. passport everywhere you go. If you should retire, you can do that anywhere in the world. You still get your Social Security check coming to you. So these are like all long-term advantages. But I think people need to also remember that you have to be of good moral standard and character to qualify for U.S. citizenship.
Of course.
And what that means is simply that you should not have committed any crimes at all. Or if you have committed a crime without any kind of conviction, then you should actually tell that interviewing officer at the time. Of course, you have to be a permanent resident for at least 5 years if you're not married to a U.S. citizen. If you are, then it's 3 years you can apply for citizenship. Of course, you have to be able to read, write, and speak English and have a knowledge of U.S. history and government. And really, they look more at the moral character now, because they are really weeding out criminal immigrants from this country at a very, very rapid rate.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We're chatting with Felicia Passad, CEO of News Americas and Heartbeat News. Felicia, what else is happening in the Caribbean that you feel is that we should bring to fore and inform our listeners about? Of importance.
Absolutely, Ron. There is a very interesting scenario that's developing between Barbados and Trinidad. In fact, the Barbados and Trinidad Prime Minister have been at loggerheads recently over this low-cost airline that is called RedJet.
Yes.
So Barbados has actually approved that travel for RedJet, and it is traveling between Barbados and Guyana, but Trinidad is continuing to hold out, and this week at the CARICOM summit, the prime ministers of both countries sort of clashed. And it was very interesting because the prime minister of Barbados, you never really hear much from him.
Yes, he's kind of low key, isn't he?
Yeah, he's very low key. This is sort of like the first major thing that he's even said since he's taken office. And so it's very interesting because I don't understand what, I like him, I don't understand what the concern for Trinidad is, but the Prime Minister continues to claim that they have security concerns about airline. Meanwhile, all the other countries are going ahead and seeing this as an opportunity, because interregional travel, it's terribly needed.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not doing a good job at all.
That's right. And even, I think, Caribbean Airlines also fell into some muddy waters. No pun intended.
Now they've taken over Air Jamaica. They're in sort of doing so many things at the same time. So I think people are desperate for a low-cost carrier, and RedJet seems to be like the choice. I think they should give them a chance. It is all about competition. Why not? If we have JetBlue flying there, why not have something interregionally? Because it's ridiculous when you pay so much more money flying from Jamaica to Guyana than you do from New York to Jamaica.
Because, you know, that has been one of the problems within the Caribbean, especially you may be flying from either North America or Europe, and it could take you maybe a day and a half, you know, to get to the Caribbean. You get to the region, but then again, you have to now overnight just to get next door.
Definitely. And that is the concern that I think many leaders are seeing, including Barbados. I think St. Kitts is getting ready to also approve the RedJet. Guyana has already approved it. So I think Trinidad is the only one, and I'm not sure what that is. I have my own opinions about that, which I'm not going to make public. But maybe if Jack Warner was, you know, sort of in the loop from the beginning, I don't think RedJet would have a problem at this stage of the game. I think RedJet made a very big mistake by, you know, sort of ignoring Mr. Warner earlier on, and that is sort of, I think, what they're paying for right now.
Who is operating RedJet, Felicia?
It is an Irish businessman out of Ireland, I believe, and they basically come in, just like Digicel, come into the region, and they're investing and trying to make a difference, and it seems like they're facing so many obstacles. And, you know, that's the thing about regional governments. They talk about investment and how much they need and what they need, but when people do come, there is so much red tape and bureaucracy that they have to jump through, that it really is not worth it at the end of the day for the investors. And that is something I think RedJet is facing, because they're really doing a good job, I think, of the promotion and pushing this whole low-cost carrier thing. I don't think Liat really is happy about this at all.
What's happening on the local scenes there in New York? Anything new, anything exciting?
Well, not really, except for the fact that, of course, Michel Martelly was recently here in New York drumming up the diaspora. But on top of that, he just this week selected a second choice for prime minister that is also not going over very well.
Right.
Bernard Grouse, who was a former justice minister, who actually was responsible for the arrest of many of Jean Bertrand Aristide's supporters after 2004, is now the choice, the second choice for prime minister, and that is also not going very well with some of the lawmakers. And since Martelly has no control over the parliament, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. Meanwhile, the country and the government are sort of in limbo because they can't do anything without a prime minister. So poor Haitians, again, are the ones suffering, and people are still living in those horrible tent cities and starving. You know, Ron, I think we need to consistently talk about that, especially about the very, very poor Haitians who are really, I mean, just the basic necessities of life. Food and water are so elusive sometimes to them. And that is a reality. I just have a friend who is from Guyana, incidentally, and lives in Haiti and works in Haiti, and just shared some really horrendous stories with me that really broke my heart to hear the kind of, you know, scenarios that people have to live with in Haiti every day, and things we take for granted here that is just, you know, just basic breakfast in the morning. Sometimes children go to school without breakfast. And these are what they consider middle-class families who can only afford one meal a day, one main meal a day. So if you eat dinner the night before, then the next morning there is nothing coming until dinner. And these are kids living in this sort of situation, you know?
I was reading, I think, a section there of Haiti. I think the mayor had removed thousands of Haitians who were living under tents, because apparently they needed that area for some development of some sort. Did you hear anything?
That is the reality. The rich continue to get richer in Haiti, and it's a sad reality because most of the rich are also themselves Haitians who are basically living off the backs of these poor people. So what is also happening in Haiti is that there is the introduction beyond the national foods that people are accustomed to. There is now the introduction of the hot dog sausage, and that has become the cheapest means of sustenance for most Haitians who are so very dirt poor. So that is really, it's the dollar sometimes, so it's very hard to get, but then you buy it, and that really becomes your meal with some rice for the day. And this is the reality. And who are the ones selling and introducing this stuff? The bourgeoisie Haitians who control the economy of the country and who are driving around enjoying life like Duvalier and jazz clubs and really living it up off the backs of poor Haitians.
Speaking of Duvalier, are both him and Jean-Bertrand Aristide still in Haiti? We hate her absolutely
are,
nothing.
They most definitely are, exactly, because Duvalier is in the social scene and with the elites, that nobody talks about that. Aristide has been extremely quiet, largely, I'm told, in his home, not doing a whole lot beyond that. And I think the UN is also, this week, there was a call for him, for Duvalier, to be basically prosecuted and be brought up for all the crimes he committed against humanity. So it still is an interest to the international community, but with Michel Martelly as president, is that even going to happen, or is he going to completely give both sides, as he did say before he became president, give them both a reprieve from whatever crimes it is alleged that they committed? And that is something I think that is going to happen when you start looking at the choices that Martelly is making in terms of the prime ministerial candidates that he wants to help run the country. The former prime minister he picked, Daniel Rousseau, his father was actually a minister in the government of Duvalier. So you see what the whole incestuous relationship becomes when you look at what is happening in the administration now.
Because a lot of people really wanted to find out the purpose for both of them returning to the country, looking for some kind of effectiveness out of them.
It seems that they are just sort of, like they had said, I guess they really meant it. They wanted to return to their homeland to just live out their days, and seems that's exactly what they're doing. Except Duvalier committed so much horrendous crimes, but he is out there free as a lark and really enjoying life, because from what I'm told, he's out most nights on the jazz circuits just really enjoying life and living it up, having dinners, having all these people in the elite circle welcome him back and just celebrate him. And it really is nauseating to some who have to sit by and watch this and compare it to what poor people are living with on a daily basis.
Oh, boy. Yeah, because, you know, they both returned just about at the time when they were preparing for the elections, but apparently their motive for returning was not what many Haitians and other folks around the world expected. Oh, boy.
I think with Duvalier, it's sort of a subtle thing, because he already has the sort of in with the current administration, so I don't think he has to do much, because his implants are already in there.
Okay.
and they're basically going to look out for him. With Aristide, it's a little more touchy, but I don't think Martelly can do anything to Aristide because he's not really doing anything to Duvalier. So he has to have the same rule apply for both former leaders.
Oh, well. Interesting. Anything else before we let you go, Felicia?
Well, I think there's also the search on in New York for Nicki Minaj's, the killer of
his cousin. Right.
Yes, a young man, again, black-on-black crime, shot down in Brooklyn. The killer they're still looking for, but he was shot down in on Farragut Road. And it really is a travesty, because it's also, he's only 27, and apparently, you know, really had a bright future in front of him. So it's a very sad situation, I think, for Nicki and her family, and hopefully they can find that killer soon. And also another positive news, Ron, You know, we had this visa situation with the reggae artists from Jamaica coming up here. A lot of them had lost their visas. Well, incidentally, last Saturday, dancehall artist Movado was back on U.S. soil, so his visa has obviously been reinstated, and
right,
I think
right.
that is something that a lot of promoters are going to be very happy about, especially this summer.
Well, as usual, Felicia, thank you very much for joining us here on Caribbean Forum, and I look forward to chatting with you again.
Always a pleasure, Ron. Have a great one.
Thank you. You do the same. Yeah, that was Felicia Passard. This
This is Max Rameau with Take Back the Land and the Omojo Village. You are listening to UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution.
Hi, I'm Raven Simone for the American Red Cross. I know that everyone is busy these days. Whether you have a job or go to school, sometimes it's hard enough to find the time to catch your breath. But preparing for a disaster or an emergency doesn't have to take a lot of your time. Get Red Cross ready for disasters by taking three steps. Talk to your family about making a disaster supplies kit, creating a family communication plan, and be sure to stay informed. To learn more, visit www.redcross.org today.
On Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Semple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. Music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
Look at the eyes, the concentration. Trying to unsettle the new batsman. Yes, this is fast bowling. They really are going to get it in at him.
Oh, it's a good bouncer.
That is a quick ball.
When he wants to turn it on, he's quick.
Oh, yes, that is a fine, aggressive, nasty delivery.
All of a sudden, these West Indians are starting to turn it on.
Short into the body.
You watch this. I reckon this one will be straight at the jaw as well. Oh, and again, it whizzes past his nose. This is pace like fire.
Shooting up, cutting back, snakes in a long way.
That is a magnificent ball. The West Indies reckon they're on a roll here.
Keep his eye on the ball. You've got to keep looking at it. Look at it, look at it.
Oh, he's hit him.
That's hurt. That's hurt.
I've often wondered why he doesn't wear the proper protection. That may have broken his jaw. It's beginning to swell as we
speak. That's not right. I really don't care whether you're a West Indian or an Englishman. That cannot be right in cricket.
All the negative things which were said, a lot of folks felt that we were spoiling the game. We were aiming to kill. No. Aggression meets aggression, and that's how I look at life. You fight, I'm going to fight. We had a mission, and a mission that we believed in ourselves, and we believed that we were just as good as anyone. Equal, for that matter.
All is fair in love and war.
You know, it was important for me to try and instill some of this belief. It wasn't going to take ordinary individuals to accomplish that. These were a special bunch who felt the same way, had the same special consciousness. It was a magnificent combination.
You're speaking about a group of black guys being successful for a period of time people couldn't imagine was possible.
The teams before were still subservient to the English. They still listened to what the English had to say about their own game. We were called terrorists, and that's a fact, that's not a boast.
The West Indians, a very, very formidable bowling team.
It was representing a region, representing something more significant than just cricket. It was a matter of feeling of worth.
know, we were playing to show our people that we were going to make them proud.
We were setting standards that future West Indian generations would have to aspire to.
That sort of environment that could either make you or break you. And you got to make a choice which one you want.
And we always thought that the day will come when we will beat the rest of the world.
In the West Indies, the greatest cricketer is found. We, the Caribbean people, on a whole, have some kind of a knowledge of how to hold a bat or how to bowl a ball. Cricket is something that is a daily situation. We play cricket for the value of cricket. Hey, don't you want to say that? Listen up. Keep the dog them round, sir. Lift the dog when the dog go round. They play with him. Clap him again. Good. Mommy dealing with him, man. Hey, just make the dog go round, sir. That's the kind of spirit that's in the Jamaican people for cricket.
People picture the sunlit islands of the Caribbean to be a place of paradise. But things were not always so peaceful. Our history has been a long and painful struggle against forces that denied and oppressed us, Babylon. And only through cricket could we win our freedom. The 60s and 70s particularly, it was a real revolutionary time throughout the Caribbean that highlighted the tenor and the temper of the times. Black people were still not regarded as equals. This whole disparity between have and have not, white as have and black as have not, still existed. In the Caribbean, as in America, black power fervor was very much on the rise, so very much part of the upheavals at the time. To imbibe in black West Indians a sense now of your own power, of your own self-worth and pride. I taught history, young teacher, involved in the whole revolutionary cosmic. I had established a very close relationship with Viv. You know, a lot of those youngsters at the time were very interested in the black power philosophies that were being talked about, and Viv would have been no exception.
That was the time where I think the heat was on for you to start getting up and standing up because of some of the things that you felt were happening worldwide. There was a journey for us as black people. Africa had us to be the starting point.
The Caribbean people were brought here through colonialism to be cheated of origin, culture, will and bravery, transmitted by the chain, the lynch, and the lash, conditioned and trained to be a nigger.
You are remnants of your ancestors, for sure. It runs in the blood. It is a history of a period that one should never forget.
Cricket itself was used as one of the instruments of colonizing and was very much seen as imparting English aristocratic values to discipline the nigger. And now here it is, we have ex-slaves trying to excel in something which the English masters had brought on.
We have an avenue to accomplish, and that avenue, it's the God-given talent of cricket. It's about showing how equal you are and prove that you are a little bit more useful than they see you.
So that's the kind of fight, that's the kind of struggle, and they know they have something to do with righting that wrong.
It took English society some time to recognize that African people felt that they were stripped of something by colonialism and slavery, and this latest generation want to restore a dignity what was taken. This is the age of the major Caribbean territories asserting their independence. Jamaica in 62, Trinidad, Guyana and Barbados in 66. independence was seen as the high point of a civil rights struggle that had gone on for 100 years.
We had been born in colonial times. We grew up in independent times. We started thinking like West Indians and not like Englishmen who were living in the West Indies. We all had ambitions. We wanted to be something to prove that we've emerged from being a slave. We wanted to show our emergence as a nation.
The existing superstructure has handed out crumbs. We don't want any crumbs, we want the whole loaf now.
This team is really, in fact, a mouthpiece for these transformations, reflecting the confidence of this independence generation. There's no going back. Cricket has to lead the way, and we have to go through the future as fast as we can.
To see someone of your color representing you at that level gave us as folks upliftment.
Those guys were heroes, people that epitomized the struggle. That also was a part of the struggle of the Caribbean.
It started to take that side of consciousness, and I could identify more than anything else the pain which our brothers and sisters would have been through.
Their fight certainly was our fight too. Through the cricket, we would be able to carry a message to the white world to balk this racism by defeating it on the field of play, by truly making the cricket field a level playing field.
Cricket, lovely cricket, I thought your eyes saw it. Cricket, lovely cricket, I thought your eyes saw it. Be your confidence and he put in action defense. Him get the ball, then take one with second West Indies in this one. With those little calls of mine, Ramadan and Palestine.
The West Indies is made up of a host of different islands. All have different governments, all have different attitudes towards different things. And those islands only come together under the banner of the West Indies cricket team. The only thing we do together.
We are very different. And if you travel the Caribbean, the accent's different. The food is different. You experience a variety of things in different islands. So our play, our cricket, spoke for us.
Cricket was it. Anybody who grew up in the West Indies wanted to play cricket for the West Indies.
You would walk miles and miles. You would find yourself at the beach. Some match was going on and you would join in. Guys would be batting from the time they come home from school until the light faded.
As soon as you get out, you're back in the water again, or you would be looking around trying to help a fishing boat.
When you did catch something that was worthwhile eating, you tend to light a fire, you ate it.
It was all fun-loving stuff, and wow, have a great time.
Friendship and bonding and being more or less free.
Every time you bowled, you were Lance Gibbs or Wes Hall or somebody. You know, every time you batted, you were Seymour Norris.
Sir Frank Worrell, Sir Gary Sobers, Sir Everton Weeks, and all the numerous names. These guys gave you hope. Pioneers, for sure, they were the inspiration.
What still persisted up until 1960 was that a white man would always be the captain of the West Indies team. It was extremely meaningful to Caribbean people to see a black man now as captain. It thrilled their heart.
Excellent cricketers will always be in the annals of the world, but they were not winning combinations.
There were sparks and flashes of genius, followed by droughts of performances.
There was a period where there were 21 test matches. None of them were West Indian victories.
People would look at us as happy-go-lucky bunch of people who just like to... Well, the name they had at that time was Calypso Cricketers.
You may say that it has some good connotation because Calypso is great music. But at the same time, it had some pretty bad connotations in that it meant that, okay, you're all fun, frolic, but no real substance, entertaining the crowd and then losing.
When they left Australia in 1961, they were given a motorcade that included 1 million people through Melbourne for losing in gentlemanly fashion.
We were entertainers, but we were not winners. And they always felt at any time we could collapse and we had no backbone.
It was felt in the Caribbean. Perhaps the feeling was, well, just keep them as the way they are so they can just play cricket, because maybe they can't do anything else. We all came from very different backgrounds, and to mold it into a unit was never going to be easy.
You have to have someone who can keep all those people from different islands together and bond them and get them pointing in the same direction.
In the Caribbean, we have a saying that 10 youngsters thrown together is not a team, it's a gang, and there is a fundamental difference. This latest generation needed a great captain.
My word, a West Indies looking to him now.
Clay Lloyd was a very quiet man, very seated, very cool, very calm, a real thinker. The players looked up to him and respected him as their leader. And he was a leader. He wasn't just a captain, he was a leader.
Clive was someone that you could approach. You thought to yourself, this is someone I want to play for. This is somebody I want to go out on the field with.
He was very conscious of his own family background, losing his father at an early age. He was the breadwinner of the family.
Clive was the father. He just led the way. He was just the man.
10 years older, leading some young boys. He mentored them. He really led them on and off the field.
He instilled that thought process that, look, we are strong people. We came from a strong people. We came from kings and queens. And we will go back to that which is strong. We are not here to make fun. We are here to win.
I wanted to have a different team with different thinking. Shed all the stuff that we had before. We are now a team, a West Indian team, working together so that the young people can understand that, hey, we can work for a better life and a better future. One people, one nation, one destiny.
1975, and we're at the start of our journey, full of youthful ambition and eager to uproot the prejudices of Babylon. Still, we had everything to prove at the top level of the game, Test cricket. A five-day contest battling against an opponent. Very soon, we'll be facing the toughest test of all, travelling to Australia to face the champions on their home soil.
Shot one, take four.
Sweat all day in burning sun. Aussie facemen love punch fun. Batsman will rule dirty green. He gets 100 runs by team.
Already there's an air of expectancy. Their dashing captain, Clive Lloyd, is quietly spoken but determined.
And are you very confident of winning?
We want to win, there's no doubt about that. It has been billed as a sort of world championship. So I'm hoping that we can give our best.
At the moment, the Australian side, to my mind, is the best in the world. And I think fast bowlers all through Test history have been the difference between a good side and a great side. Thompson and Lilly are great bowlers.
Jeff Thompson and Dennis Lilly are the most talked about cricketers in the world. The underlying point is controversy. Controversy about bounces or bumpers, deliberate intimidation, aiming to hit the batsman, and bowling bounces at tail enders.
Splendid bowling performance then from Jeff Thompson. He bowled really fast today, as indeed he has done throughout this match, and a great psychological boost for him and for the whole of the Australian side.
Lilly has struck again. Another great performance there by Lilly.
That cricket team decimated every other cricket team around the world. They beat everybody at home and abroad. They nearly killed England.
Thompson to Lloyd. And hit badly there that time.
I remember the English literally running for cover and begging for mercy.
Australia had outstanding fast bowlers. Fast bowlers, and when I say fast bowlers, I'm talking about people who really bowl fast. Not talking about people who just bowl 80, 81 miles an hour. Talking about people who bowl 90, 90 odd miles an hour. Because that extra dimension is whether you can get hurt or not.
And that's hit him on the head, a bad one. The batsman is down.
He will get killed. It has happened. It's like a bullet. If there's something in front of it, you could be dead.
Now, once you have the capability
of hurting someone with that ball, that person is not thinking about how to play the ball. He's thinking about self-preservation.
I'm trying to scare him, trying to hurt him perhaps in the ribs or the leg or something like that, so that he at least knows you're around.
Dennis Lilly would stand in front of you and he stands up, this enormous figure, look you in the eye.
He wanted that ball to cause me a great deal of harm. He wanted to inflict pain. He wanted to injure me.
The one individual that you found just very difficult to play would be Jeff Thompson. He was ruthless, in my opinion.
Thomas was a danger. He was a danger man.
Thompson's sport away from the Test match arena helps keep him fit for hurling down his thunderbolts. It takes a lot of running with a zest akin to collecting Test scalps.
What do you think about that climb?
And he was a mean man.
My word, it does look a picture today. It's always a great moment. A nerve-wracking one for some players, an exciting one for others.
It is the test of all tests. That's why they call it the test. Test matches. To be out in the field for 5 days, you have to have the endurance. The race is not for the swift, but who can endure to the end? That's the test. That's the test of every player.
A lot of young people were in that West Indies team. That was either their first tour or their second tour.
We were green, we were young, we were inexperienced, thrust into international cricket, thrown in at the deep end. You went out and all you could hear screaming in your ears was
Lily, Lily, kill, kill, kill. Lily, Lily, kill, kill, kill.
You felt that there can't be a lot of love going on here.
It is in your face. It wasn't easy walking out to face those guys with the crowd almost on top of you.
Out there, it was a war. Believe me, it was a war. And they didn't let up. They threw the kitchen sink, they threw everything at you. They let you know, well, we're in charge and you're not coming on our patch to do well.
It was as if fired out of a rifle.
Lilly and Thompson, they bounced any and everyone. People were bobbing and weaving and ducking and falling on their backsides, trying to get away.
A serious induction into fast bowling, that was terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
I remember Lilly bowling a bouncer to Lance Gibbs, and Lance, at the end of the day, went up to him and said, listen, I've got a wife and kids, be careful what you're doing.
Let's bowl with fire and direction.
And that just hit him in the face, I think.
Serious ball, Richie. I think it got him on the jaw.
That climbed straight up.
Injuries, broken fingers, broken shoulders, cracks on the head, and it was humiliating. It was like a military assault on West Indies cricket.
Held him. The off stump cartwheeling back almost a match.
Oh, a ball. Yeah. Well put. That was a lovely piece of cricket by the Australians.
Move to Richards.
Is it here? He's out. Steph Thompson at his best. That's out. Oh. Green bowled. Roberts is out.
That was a nasty series and lots of confrontations on and off the field.
They knew. They were seasoned campaigners and they knew when to turn the screws.
Some of the Aussies has this way that if they could not get you out, they would rather abuse you out.
Things were said and the color of your skin came into it. When you're constantly being bombarded with comments and behavior, well, I encountered some ignorance before. But this was very different, very, very different.
The crowd, people in the crowd did say things that shouldn't have been said, things that weren't politically correct, where people would tell you about your heritage or your background or go back to the trees that you came from.
You black bastard. And I get rather annoyed anyone's going to call me a black bastard because I'm not.
You stop and look and see where the comment came from, then they would laugh and so on because to them it's a big joke. It degraded me and downgraded me a great deal.
I was naive going to Australia and I thought Test cricket was a gentleman's game. I lost it. I just could not believe that this was taking place.
Michael just went and sat down and could not believe, and tears was coming out of his eyes saying he don't know how guys could play cricket like this so hard.
And yes, there was a lot of bickering. People started to blame each other. Batsmen blaming bowlers. The bowlers blaming batsmen. It was not a very happy dressing room. And it was not a happy time.
So there it is. Australia winning by 7 wickets.
We got a job in. They beat us 5-1.
When the West Indies were annihilated, that burned everybody in the West Indies really badly.
Do you feel it? With tears come. I see people cry when West Indies lose. When West Indies go down, you know, people tears come down.
Very disappointed, man. Very, very disappointed.
We're wondering now if we can come back up. When?
People didn't feel the West Indies players had the fight in them. This Calypso cricket stigma stuck with us. We weren't willing to go there and fight to the end, and we just gave up.
When that team returned to the Caribbean, it was like soldiers coming home from a war. They realized that everything was at stake. And Clive Lloyd knew that West Indian cricket was at the crossroads.
A lot of soul searching went on during that time. Clive, as a young captain, was under pressure. He became very depressed, even questioned his own right to be the captain.
They say, after humiliation is riches, power, might, and blessing eternally, forever. Go run, fight, run, fight.
Fight is a game. You have to put your heart in to play and keep it up.
Yes.
No. Don't go down. Fight.
Yes. Launch an attack, come quick. Launch an attack now. Launch an attack, come quick. Launch an attack. Could you hear me?
I can remember Clive said, "Never again." If we can find some fast bowlers who are just as quick as they are, or even quicker, let us see how well they handle it.
Clive Lloyd took a very blunt decision. We can also play your game. We can generate a bowling machinery that will obliterate, that can rub you into the ground and decimate.
And I need bowl, and it's a 4. I need bowl, and it's a 6. Yes.
So he needed very fast bowlers. And he went through the Caribbean looking for players to fit into his machine. He had already picked Michael Holden and saw the talent and the brilliance of this young man.
And people questioned Clive Lloyd's knowledge. Say, Clive Lloyd, oh, you're bringing Michael Holden, and he's only 17. But Clive said, don't watch that. This little youth, I like him potential. The captains were so astute. Such cricket brain come once in a lifetime.
Oh, Lord, yes.
First, you had 3. Wayne Daniel, Holding, and Roberts. Fast, furious, aggressive, and really could dismiss you.
It was very skillfully done. It was a superb construction.
This is cricket, lovely cricket. Yes, cricket, lovely cricket. Man, I mean, say, people, are you ready? Blow! Oh, Lord.
What a solid.
Hi, I'm Alan Bomar Jones, and you're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Simple.
This is Max Rameau with Take Back the Land and the Omojo Village. You are listening to UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution.
This is Felicia Prasad. The Uhuru Radio Network has news and culture direct from Africa, the Caribbean, and wherever Africans are working, playing, and fighting to be free. Support Uhuru today.
This is your Caribbean News in Brief from News Americas Now. I'm Ken Webb. A World Cup soccer corruption investigation has finished up. The Prime Minister of Barbados speaks out about RedJet Airlines and Trinidad and Tobago. And what does Bridgetown, Barbados have in common with the pyramids of Egypt, the Statue of Liberty, and the Great Wall of China? A World Cup soccer corruption investigation has concluded, and there's fresh evidence to support claims that Jack Warner and Mohammed bin Hammam colluded to offer bribes. A FIFA investigation has reportedly found that the two colluded to offer bribes of up to $1 million to Caribbean football officials to vote for bin Hammam as the next FIFA president. The investigation was conducted by former FBI Director Louis Free. However, Warner no longer faces FIFA sanctions.
having resigned from all football posts. The usually quiet Barbados Prime Minister, Frendel Stewart, is mincing no words when it comes to the issue of Trinidad and Tobago and the Red Jet Airlines application. Stewart this week accused Trinidad and Tobago's administration of conducting a smear campaign against the low-cost carrier. He pointed to a meeting held in Trinidad last month where Barbados Minister of International Transport, George Hudson, was shown apparently questionable photographs about the airline at a meeting of civil aviation ministers. Barbados has already certified Red Jet as safe, even as Trinidad and Tobago's Prime Minister Kamla Prasad Bisesar said her country has safety concerns about the airline. Red Jet is awaiting licenses to operate between Barbados and Trinidad and Tobago and Jamaica. The airline already operates scheduled flights to Guyana. Historic Bridgetown, Barbados and its garrison are now World Heritage Sites. The two locations are included in the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization World Heritage Site List. This means Bridgetown and its garrison are now included among the pyramids of Egypt, the Statue of Liberty, and the Great Wall of China. This is Carib World News Brief from News America's Now. On the ET scene, dancehall artist Mavado is back on U.S. soil. After more than a year-long absence due to a denial of a U.S. visa, the singer, born David Constantine Brooks, landed on July 2nd and exited JFK Airport here in New York without incident. Mavado had had his visa canceled by the U.S. Embassy in Jamaica last April, along with Bounty Killer, Beanie Man, Adonia, and selector Ricky Trooper. No reason was given at the time for the revocation. In sports, look out for the resurgence of the CARICOM Prime Minister's Subcommittee on Cricket. Newly minted CARICOM Chair St. Kitts Nevis Prime Minister Dr. Denzil Douglas announced the decision after former West Indies skipper Chris Gayle appealed for the body to step in regarding his dispute with the West Indies Cricket Board. The Jamaica-born Gayle and the WICB have been at loggerheads since he and senior players were criticized by coach Otis Gibson in the World Cup aftermath. The top batsman has called the WICB attempts at reconciliation a sham and mockery. Prime Minister Douglas says the subcommittee is being reactivated to see if it can understand the differences between the two parties and how they can advance a true cause for West Indies cricket. That's this week's Caribbean World News in Brief from News America's Now. Until next week, I'm Ken Webb.
There's always been the demon black fast bowler. Young, strapped in box, releasing a thunderbolt at you, it can become something of a firing lion.
When you look at a Michael Holden running into bowl, what you're looking at is an African individual with African rhythm.
Yeah, that's really one in a million, born to bowl a cricket ball.
Michael, in that stride, would put fear into any particular batsman.
I was just a young man running in, bowling fast, attracting attention. Look out for this guy, he's coming.
Andy Roberts was one of the hard-nosed individuals on the team. A guy that you would take in the battle anywhere, you know.
I'm a warrior. I take fast bowling more seriously than anything else.
I would say Andy was misunderstood because he hardly ever smiled, and people thought he was just a grumpy, miserable guy.
Never shown emotion, so nobody knew what to expect. That was me.
Andy taught me a lot about fast bowling, taught me a lot about cricket.
I could set you up easy. He knew how to catch a fish.
Andy used to have two different bouncers. The first one, the batsman, would sometimes hook it away and get a boundary. And the second one, with the same action, same effort, would be a great deal quicker. And of course, the batsman would feel some pain.
He could hurt you, seriously hurt you.
And he was the original leader of that pace attack.
Not long after Australia, we returned home to play India. We were eager to banish our humiliation and to show we had the character to win. For Clive, it was the opportunity to start blooding the newly formed pace attack. The pressure was on and was to reach boiling point in Kingston.
The whole Jamaica come to see it. We packed like a sardine.
There was the feeling that now we were unleashing this firing power.
let's play the type of cricket that they do not associate us with.
Our guys go out to show that they learned something from Australia.
How would the Indians withstand our head-on onslaught?
My heart started beating hard. And they see him running. And then they deliver the ball, right?
We were making India really buckle under a pressure here, you know. The Indian team was like the walking wounded.
All of them and broke. Everybody head get leak. You understand?
The Indians thought we were overdoing the fast bowling, surrendered the test match to the West Indies almost as a show of protest.
It takes a lot of guts to face fast bowling. Most people who don't expect to get it complain. Every time I go out to bat, I expect to get my share. Australia 75, 76, we didn't complain. If we can't take the heat and if it can't take the pace, get out.
I believe that, unfortunately, the Indians were there to receive the brunt of the revised strategy and the desperation to restore pride. What you saw then was a team that had its mind made up. Do or die, ask no quarter and give none.
That theory was reinforced in Clive's mind because of the results that we got. I think then people realized, oh, okay, it can work, and it has worked.
Beating India was the first sign we had the firepower to win. It was a success, but it was still early days for the team. Soon after, we had to face our oldest enemy in the fiercest grudge match of all. It was 1976, and we boarded the plane to England. Could we beat our former masters at the game they created?
This drive and ambition was always towards England specifically, seeing cricket as the vehicle through which they were expressing rebellion against this British colonizing power.
We were playing against our old masters, and therefore we had to up our game to be able to beat them.
We wanted to show Englishmen, you brought the game to us, and you know that we are better than you.
The English, as you know, do adore test match cricket. England would rather lose a battleship than to lose a test match. We're hearing that, you know how serious it is.
Beating England was more satisfying to me than anybody else, because I believe that we struggled more in England than anywhere else in the world.
As usual in those times, my family had moved to England in the hope of a better life.
A pathetic sight. Already their coming has caused a national controversy. What will they find in the land they regard as an Eldorado?
At 14, having to leave the Caribbean was very difficult. Arriving in England, thrust into an environment that you know nothing about, being confronted with a variety of things.
Well, of course, there are far too many immigrants in this country.
We do not have sufficient houses, jobs and schools for our own people, let alone immigrants.
And unless something's done about this quick, that prejudice is going to be sheer bloody hatred.
There was a vacancy for a flat, and on the stairs they were saying, all applicants accepted, no Irish or black.
During the early 70s, I didn't have an understanding of what racism was all about. Had no experience whatsoever. It was called a WOG. I said, what the hell is that?
When guys got angry, the things that you would hear, you black this, you black that.
You know, at times you felt, well, you know, I think I would like to be back in the Caribbean now rather than be here. My anger came out in the way I played. I felt that to forcefully go at what I was doing, to attack, perhaps was a way of letting out that anger. Well, it wouldn't be right to do it on another human being, although you felt like it at times, but I'm going to sure take it out on 5.5 ounces. So you just take it out on the ball.
Every little bit of power you can imagine going into that string.
My bat would have been my sword at that time, and it's people who you wanted to put it to.
Everyone wanted to give the West Indian people living in England something to hold on to. People who were looking up to you, who were willing you on for support.
If the West Indies lose, they're even afraid to go to work because they know that their workmates will shout abuse and they can't live it down. All they had to boast about was the success of the West Indies team.
It was a step beyond the sport where there's a whole lot of things needed defending rather than the cricket ball itself.
People are building these West Indians up. I'm not really quite sure that they're as good as everyone thinks they are. If they're down, they grovel. And I intend, with the help of Closey and a few others, to make them grovel.
Grovel.
They grovel.
Grovel.
To make them grovel.
That wasn't a clever thing to say. The timing was very, very wrong, especially given the situation in South Africa with apartheid.
Here was this guy, you know, apartheid still going strong, and he's going to make these black guys grovel.
The appetite was there immediately. Clive Lloyd said, guys, we don't need to say much. Our man on the television have just said it all for us. We know what we got to do. We took that seriously. Very, very serious we took it.
I've not seen our guys so focused. That comment alone was sufficient to set the tone for the whole series. The bowlers, they really turned on the heat. He made the others suffer for what he said.
Hit him hard, and in typical Closey style, he hasn't rubbed it.
My word, Brian Close did well to avoid quite a nasty accident there. It was really fired in extremely quickly. Only at the last possible minute did he manage to get that head out of the way. That's hurt him. That's somewhere round about the mark where earlier he let one bounce off him. That really must have stung him. Close trying to take this pace attack, but extremely difficult. Enough is enough. He's really overdone the short pitches. Brian Close is going to be a mass of bruises when he gets back into the haven of the pavilion.
A new row has erupted over dangerous bowling. A former chairman of the Cricket Society warns that unless rules are tightened, 10 cricketers will die and 40 more will suffer brain injury through being hit by a ball this summer.
The world more or less portrays the West Indies team as brutal, bring the game into disrepute. But the adrenaline that's going to be pumping, the tension that would have mounted from that ill-fated comment, you're going to release that ball at a serious pace.
There were umpires that in the laws of the game were allowed to act to protect people. You don't want to hurt someone, inevitably a batsman will get hurt. And you regret that.
I always feel when I hit a batsman, the sympathy is in here. You may not see it, and I can't show the batsman that. But it's just that I have a job to do.
We're not going to be these happy-go-lucky cricketers that only here to entertain. We're going to entertain by this high skill. And whatever it takes to win within the rules of the game, we're going to do it to win.
Oh, and that's a fine ball. Holding strikes again.
We were made to feel at home, away from home. The crowds supported us because of the way we played.
People turned up in their droves, and one section of the ground was just all West Indians and having a ball.
As good a shot as you will ever see.
Everyone said it was the hottest summer in England for donkey's years. Well, I think the heat was felt by the English, not by the West Indians.
That's really good bowling from Andy Roberts.
Spectators that hardly have had better entertainment.
The crowd, more so than anyone else, took a turn at Tony for what he said. They reminded him and they kept on repeating it. So I think he got the message.
Whenever he came into bat, he would have it. If they were tired, guys would find the strength just to make sure. And it wasn't getting him out caught in the slips. It was like just knocking his poles over. Bang. Wow, those were some special moments.
A very disappointed, disenchanted Tony Gregg there.
You can forgive, but you never ever forget.
Righteousness must always stand, because if it don't, prophecy will fulfill upon you, and you will cry like God.
Michael Holden and myself had great summers in 76. Viv Richards had a great summer in 76. So it was bat versus ball in 76.
Every test match that Viv played in, he looked invincible.
Yeah! And a terrific shot, this really master batsman.
The master blaster has arrived.
There was so much talk about intimidatory bowling. Well, we had a batsman that didn't mind if he bowled six bouncers at him.
He would not have been scared. He came and stood his own, you know. Take that in your ass, man. Bat, man. You have a bat in your hand. Defend yourself. That sort of attitude.
Some said I had a little swagger. It's my sign of saying I'm so confident here, you know. With some chewing gum in mouth, I back myself every time.
What a shot. It's no use bowling this fella.
They battled against the fastest of bowlers and totally took everyone apart.
I could knock him back as well. You better get out of the way.
The bowler afraid of Vivian Richard instead of Vivian Richard afraid of the bowler.
If it wasn't confrontational, I felt that you were a kitten. And if it wasn't in my face, you wouldn't see the best of Vivian Richards.
Vivi is the name, cricket is the game. Brother, I don't know how he could play cricket so, but his batting, bowling, feeling, catching is breathtaking. Sometimes I does wonder if he's an ex-sober's in the making. That man Richards could really bat. It's something to see him and the attack, plundering bowlers again and again. It's remarkable how he does dictate the game. No bowler holds a terror for Vivian Richards, not Thompson nor Lily, not Biddy nor Shandaseka. A perfect coordination of body and mind. That brother is really dynamite. I tell you, pace or spin, he ain't give a Francois, you bowling him. Fast or slowly, you're going back to the boundary.
Vivi Richards, a great man. Wonderful.
We've come a long way in the space of 1 year from the lows of Australia to victory against our colonial masters. Under Clive Lloyd, this youthful team were becoming mature men. It was a surprise to others and perhaps even ourselves. Now the big question is whether we could continue our success and beat the other test nations of the world. That question would have to wait. There was a fight against Babylon on our very own doorstep. A fight for equal rights and rewards as true professionals of the game.
For the success which we had then, there should have been more benefits coming to that team. The powers of that team should be used as a negotiating tool.
There were issues in getting to the same level of payment as the same players playing for England and Australia against the West Indies.
What sort of money do they get paid, the West Indian team?
Well, I don't know how much exactly they're getting, but certainly it wouldn't be anything in comparison to the amount of money that comes through the gate.
Almost all of the cricket boards were headed by Caucasians, whites. And that might have been perceived as trying to keep the black man down, if you will. I don't think it has race to do with it at all. Power is a numbing thing, it's like a drug.
As players, we were very upset that the West Indies Cricket Board had short-sold us.
After sport, you have to live. What they were paying to play cricket could not make me live.
We were exploited in such a degree that we were laughing stock. Who you want, some people who cheat and steal?
But then suddenly, the possibility presented itself to challenge the establishment. It was called World Series Cricket.
A revolutionary new development has come onto the scene, organized not by the traditional authorities, but by an independent Australian businessman, Kerry Packer. The result has been official apoplexy.
I fail to see how this business-type piracy is welcome to our cricket.
They are the lowest-paid team sport practically in the world, and they're entitled to the reward that their skills demand.
So here's a man like Kerry Packer coming and saying, look, guys, we want to pay you what you're worth. Kerry decided he's going to get the best West Indian cricketers, the best Australian cricketers, and the best of the rest of the world to play a three-way tournament in Australia. The win money was $30,000.
It was so far superior to what we're accustomed to. It felt like VIP. And I said, well, for this sort of money, I can't think about playing cricket. Show me where to sign. The proverbial whatever it is hit the fan.
The West Indies Cricket Board saw us as rebel players.
We were all banned from playing for the West Indies. We had no cricket to come back to.
We felt like outcasts. We were now on our own. We even thought at one point that would mean never ever play for the West Indies again. And we just did not feel good about that. What would have happened to us? What would become us?
After all the publicity, all the uproar, the haggling, the start of the Packer series was a fizzer.
Money in my pocket, but I just can't get no love.
The players took the field in front of only 500 spectators, leaving the stadium all but deserted.
Kerry realized that the success of World Series depended heavily on the success of West Indies. There was one game that we played and we got bowled out cheaply. He came into the changing room and put a tongue lashing on us.
Gentlemen, you are wasting my time. I could get rid of you immediately. Qantas 001 leaves here every afternoon and some of you could be on it. Unless you pick up your game, we are going to have to send some of you home.
Kerry Packer demanded professionalism. He demanded a professional outlook on not just your cricket, but on life. And we let him down.
And everything changed from that day.
Here we have a bunch of guys now who realize that there's no tomorrow, there's only today. And nobody wanted to give up.
We then bonded together because that's all we had. We had each other. That family feeling, that ultimate one for all for one, pervaded.
I'm gonna put on an iron shirt, put on an iron shirt.
Kerry Packer assigned Dennis Wade to the West Indies team as our physiotherapist trainer. And he went to Clive Lloyd and said, Skipper, I do not think that this team is fit enough. And that is when we started to train.
I'm gonna put on an iron shirt.
Dennis was a fit, strong man. He would run to the ground from the hotel while we took the bus.
He pushed us to the limit. I mean, madness. We were fit at all times. If we weren't fit, we were glad to get fit.
Quick single, having to hurry. And he's hit the stump, he's gone. Beautiful bit of fielding, hooks run out.
This team became the fittest test team the world had seen. Coming against a tradition of pot-bellied, unfit cricketers, the fitness led to superb displays of catches, incredible endurance. There was a spectacle.
Hit him. Oh, no comment needed.
It was highly intense cricket. Highly, highly. It was the hardest cricket I've ever played.
Every team had at least five genuine fast bowlers. Every team. Every day you wake up, you know that your cricket is going to be harder than the day before.
That whole tournament itself helped to change your whole psyche, getting fitter. Winner takes all, being in that zone to be as mean as anything else.
And a superb shot by Richards, hit it mightily hard.
There are a lot of things that introduced colored clothing. The West Indies were in pink. The press had a field day when they saw uniforms, you know, pretty in pink. And they went so far as saying the poofters in pink. So we had to show them that we were not that way disposed. From then to the end of World Series cricket, we did not lose a game.
And here comes the stampede.
And the Australians have always suggested that Kerry Packer ought not to have come in to make that speech to the West Indies.
Even though you were playing as well as you think you are and winning as much as you are, there was still something very much missing.
The West Indies crowd goes absolutely mad. Absolutely mad.
One of the things that I find with West Indian supporters is that they're loyal, love to see West Indies win, they love to see good cricket. But one of the things that they do not like is to see administrators lie to them.
The supporters wanted to know why we were still banned. They wanted their best players back. Our continued fight against the board was the same fight our people faced against our politicians. Despite independence, inept leaders still robbed us of wealth and benefits, dividing the islands for their own ends. In Clive's team, the people saw a model for cooperation and unity. Our sympathies were shared and we united as one.
We were the heroes of the West Indian public because we were standing up to our establishment board. More and more people recognized that the strength was in getting together.
What our politicians could not achieve, we did. When we were playing and we got on that field, we put aside all the differences and issues which the islands had. Uniting that region together where collectively everyone could speak as a unit.
The public were all unanimous in calling for boycotts of West Indian games. It did so much for Clive to recognize that he was accepted as the leader, not just within the team, but throughout the Caribbean.
The timing was right, and the West Indian Cricket Board's hands were tied. They had to bring us back.
You know, we came together and stuck together.
Clive returned as the undisputed leader of our cricket. No longer would politics divide our people, and we would all share in the fruits of the West Indies' success.
And that same nucleus, which was a real family who really gelled, came back into traditional cricket and felt as if, yes, we had really achieved something.
We were a much better team, fitter team, and that's what turned us into professionals. From then, I never thought we could lose a game.
During World Series cricket, Joel Garner and I forced our way into the team and the bowling chain for West Indies. The media were very interested because for the first time ever, you had four fast bowlers who could all bowl at over 90 miles per hour.
Michael Olin, Andy Roberts, Joel Garner, and Colin Kraft. Colin Kraft.
We were called the four horsemen of the apocalypse. We were called terrorists, dangerous, murderers. We were called all sorts of things.
These guys were physically intimidating. Joel Garner, 6'8".
And he was always coming either at your toes or up at your neck.
That is the enemy at the other end. Those fellas wearing the pads on the back, those were the enemy, and it's very intentionally meant life for them very uncomfortable.
Colin Kraft, him have an action you can't understand. There is a menace to society.
I was scary. I know that. You knock a guy down with a bouncer and you smile and you laugh. I am here. Get out of my way.
He asked him, Cruffy, suppose your mother was at the other end batting. He says, boy, if my mother was at the other end, she's the target.
And there was a hitman and labeled the hitman just because he was hitting people.
I hear people say that I was a hitman. I didn't go out to try to hit people. It's just that a lot of people get hit.
Colin Cowdrey, Sadiq Mohammed, Majid Khan, all the press fracture of the cheekbone. And he was so feared. They all had their different styles, but Michael was called Whispering Death.
The umpire couldn't hear me coming. He had to keep on looking behind him to see if I was actually running in. And I suppose a death came from the pace at which I bowled, that it could create death.
The team by 1979 was stronger, much, much stronger. We were on top of our game, all of us. Superb, premium. That's professional sport at the highest level.
The West Indians came and said to the cricket culture, listen, cricket can be spectacular. It is art.
They were becoming a force politically.
They are saying this is a West Indian product. They are showing on the world stage, coming out of the so-called third world, can be excellent.
There's a wind of change. Let's be better than we have ever been. We are on our way to victory of good over evil.
Clive Lloyd, you know you're the man. Colin Croft, one to the head, six to the chest. Eh? Cricket and my sports and people know that. Ball me a bowl and people know that. Coof off, Clive Lloyd, him does the classics. Score. Gone up on them seat. After Michael only bowl the ball them like Saddam Saddam. Watch it. That's why Clive Lloyd and me the cannon. Color, color. Man a real Jamaican. You know we better than the rest. Crab up.
We were made to relive 75 and 76 in Australia. Every time the highlights were shown of one of those test matches, you were never given the chance to just put it in the back of your mind. They kept on focusing on what happened.
It was so important for those of us who had been part of defeat in 1975 to have the opportunity to put that right.
At that stage, Australia were officially number one in the world. Still.
The West Indies had never won a test series in Australia, so this would have been breaking new ground.
We must beat Australia at all costs. It didn't matter how we did it, ugly, nice, we had to beat them. Psychologically, physically, every other adverb you could use, we were ready.
We encountered similar problems that we had in 75, 76. You know, they would walk past you or come down the track and so on, they would say off.
Off, you know?
Piss off or you're a wanker.
You know, you're coming into bat. Before you get there, Dennis Lilly will tell you straight out, I'm going to knock your effing head off. I'm coming for that.
Lenny Pascoe, who at one point said if I'd hooked, I was going to be a hospital case.
I think that's now taking the game to a different level.
They thought that when they threw it at us, we were just going to fall over and die and remembered what happened before. But it wasn't like that. It was a completely different story.
Gets it away, cuts hard and high.
They were taken by surprise.
I wasn't a helmet man. I didn't wear all this protective gear. I knew that there'd be a lot of forces who'd be looking to get me. The message that I sent is that I'd rather die out there. The only how I'm gonna be not here is if I'm knocked out.
Oh, nasty blow, nasty blow.
Everyone was thinking, oh hell, Viv is going to be damaged. And we're expecting Viv to be walking off the field at some point.
You cannot afford to let your opposition know when you're hurt. They stand up and they look you in the eye and I look back and we have this little steering match for a while. You know when you would have got the better of them. By the time they turn around, they pass the umpire and they get back to their mark, they will take a little look around again to see if you're still looking. I'll be still looking. You know, and that's when they know that you're serious.
For news, views, interviews, and thought-provoking discussions, tune in to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time, right here on the Uhuri Radio Network.
On Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Semple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. Music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
This is Max Rameau with Take Back the Land and the Omojo Village. You are listening to UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution.
Hi. I'm Alan Beaumar Jones, and I encourage you to support the Uhuru Radio Network because it's independent, it's community, and it's pro-black.
The bouncer coming next ball. What an answer.
And the very next ball, he hit it straight out of the ground.
Look what you've done, you know, you just bloody well pull a lion tail. They weren't saying kill, kill, kill for too long. And I think when Australia done that, it just motivated all players to get pretty mean.
Oh, that's a tackle under the heart, a nasty blow. That was a blow that would hurt. And Joel Garner saying that you can wear that one.
Four guys who we let loose on them.
He's caught that one as well.
Was just too much.
It's been a rather painful day for the Australians.
The same Australian who were so aggressive all of a sudden were crying. Can you imagine that from an Australian? You know, I could not believe it.
The harder they come, the harder they fall. When we had the pace, and the pace get real hot, they would touch it and they would walk. Because the pace is real hot.
We were talking about a peace truce. That peace truce probably lasts for a game and then it was back to normal again. Yeah. But that is how far it went at that stage.
And we kept the pressure on the opposition and we hammered them into the ground.
They bumped shit out of them.
Wow. That, I think, was special.
You know, we felt as if, yes, we had really achieved something. We had learned from our experiences. And, yes, we have now proven ourselves at the highest level.
You know, it really was a feeling that West Indies cricket has now come of age. And we really are the best team in the world.
This was the first time the West Indies had produced something which was the best the world had seen.
Here we are, several dots on the map, dominating the world.
It's difficult to describe the feeling even now.
There was joy beyond words.
We're on a high, it's celebration time.
Everything was working out to perfection.
We went to Pakistan and were the only team to beat Pakistan in Pakistan, ever. We went to India and beat India again as the only team to have done that.
West Indies bowling was poetry in motion at that time. And you have never seen it since.
We just wanted to win everything. We wanted to win every game. We put our feet on them, kept them down, and beat them.
You can't beat a team like that. Oh, you can beat a team like that.
When West Indies began to win so consistently, it triggered a pride in the workplace. It triggered a pride in the way we dressed, in the way we went into studios and recorded.
African culture had been criminalized and driven into the ground for 300 years. At the first opportunity to be free to express itself, it comes up to the surface and it comes back there again. And suddenly we have this extraordinary emergence of culture in the Caribbean.
Bob Marley and the Wailers, Jimmy Cliff, coming with aggression, abrasion, and a force of change. You combine all of that with a West Indies cricket success. Unbelievable. They thought that we were heroes, but to me, they were heroes. Bob Marley, come to the dressing room, telling you, you gotta win. Mascroft, man, ratted, we gotta get these men out quick. Brilliant. That's a period of history that will forever be the most productive time of our lives.
They start to boast. Instead of being ashamed, they can wave their flags and say, our heroes made us look good.
You know, all these tunes are totally inspiring stuff, you know, sounding the protest bell. Get up, stand up. Stand up, stand up. To me, it's not a crime, you know? It is about standing up for what you believe in. And you walk onto the field, and it's totally embedded in your mind. You may call it your battlefield music, you know?
I will never, ever forget Rip Ritton. As I speak about him now, I can picture him right there. In his heart burns the custom culture of Rastafari. he was rasterized. But a lot of people didn't know that came from him having to do with Bob Marley. He always find himself in the company of the Wailers. Had he not been involved in cricket, he would have surely been a dreadlock Rasta man. Real deal.
Viv was very, very much the darling of Caribbean peoples, you know. He was really the extension, philosophically, of Clive Lloyd, taking it now to a further consciousness of spiritual, religious thought. Viv was really becoming into the fullness of identity as an African.
Even his armband that he wore showed the African colors.
The green for the land itself, the yellow for the gold taken away and stripped away, the red meant the blood that was shed, those particular colors and what it meant.
Take time out and play this one for our brothers and sisters in South Africa. African people, unite, man. Tune, brother.
Them a come, not the dreadlocks we nah run. Never, never. Them a come, not the dreadlocks we nah run. Oh, no.
There's a great sense of sympathy for these struggles for independence in Africa at the time, be they in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, or South Africa. The anti-apartheid fight, the anti-colonial fight, was very much part of the Caribbean struggle also.
You felt seriously embodied with the folks who were suffering in South Africa. This human injustice taking place for so many years.
It was a real sense of horror. Black people were being just shot down mercilessly, and particularly those Alsatian dogs running through Soweto, biting up people, etc. It brought tears to the eyes of Caribbean watchers, man. There was always the feeling that we could do everything to assist them, not only in song and in cultural expressions, but in the field of cricket also, in imposing the sanctions against South Africa.
17 West Indian cricketers are to play in a country which has been banned from international cricket because of its apartheid policies.
So that it was a great abhorrence when some of our cricketers defied the sanctions and went to play in South Africa.
This is a major propaganda coup for South Africa. The fact that they're black will be seen as giving some credibility to the South African regime.
Most Caribbean people were in shock.
How can you go and support a regime like that?
As Kerry Packer said, every man has his price.
Money is everybody's god. Let's be honest, we have to look after yourself.
The team is believed to include Colin Croft, lured by the £70,000 contract. Former Jamaican Prime Minister Michael Manley said the rebel players were mercenaries.
I'm a mercenary? When I went to World Series cricket, was I not a mercenary then? I'm not sure I understand the differences. It's not a game. It's my livelihood. This is my job.
No, we wanted to know who else is going, who else are they after?
Every man has his price.
How he conducts himself will determine how he will rate in history.
Well, it was an open check, basically, for my figure at the time. If I had signed then I think we would have had the exodus. I think West Indies team would have dismantled at that particular period. I felt that I had to show some leadership. Not going to the apartheid regime in South Africa.
I will not go. They cannot pay me enough money. The sacrifices Viv Richards made is really heroic.
I see a serious correlation between Muhammad Ali and Viv Richards. One throwing away a medal, refusing to fight an unjust war, and the other one refusing to take a $1 million check from an unjust society.
One of the things on the table is that whilst there you're going to be an honorary white, how can a black man be an honorary white man?
What is wrong with the color of my skin? What is wrong with my ethnicity? Why should anyone tell me I've got to be an honorary anything apart from what I am? These guys have sold out. Having no accepted the term honorary white, if they paid them enough money, they'd be willing to even accept chains on their ankles. I was disgusted.
those rebel cricketers, they were bringing down the wrath of our ancestors, and they were bringing down the curses of the African spirits by having betrayed the cause of African rebellion and of African liberation.
I had an incident in South Africa where I was asked to remove myself from a train carriage because it was for whites only. It's not fine. A lot of people will say, well, look, embarrass the Caribbean. I take whatever comes with it.
West Indian cricket authorities have banned its players who've defied an international boycott and gone to play in South Africa.
They were destroyed. Their career were torn down. Their respect was, you know, to the dust, to the garbage.
Caribbean people just ostracized them, just cast them off the map totally. Their life was just generally made very miserable. Nothing good ever came of many of them. Some of them were thought to have gone kinky, getting hooked on cocaine or other debilitating drugs. And that's another devilish curse.
I had heard some of the players who came back were badly treated. I had heard that some of them had fallen in hard times. But when I came back from South Africa, I didn't come back to the West Indies. I went to Florida. It hurt to not be a part of that team, being able to walk down the street, hold your head high. That was better than millionaires. That was better than gold.
These guys will always be my friends, regardless of the decisions that they made in life. I'm not in any position to judge anyone, but the juries are out there. I met Desmond Tutu, and he said, Nelson Mandela, we appreciate what the West Indies was doing at the time. Thank you so much in helping to dismantle the apartheid regime, in helping the upliftment of some of our struggling brothers and sisters. When I heard that, I was rather moved. Wow, they knew who you were, and they knew exactly the part you played. You felt very appreciated. Yeah. The struggle goes on. Even though you were winning as much as you are, you got to be so aware and be watchful. That's when the evil side of things and the racism could easily catch you off guard. You stop taking the punches now and start giving some. All of a sudden, some have a problem with that.
Every time there have been successful black expressions, be it culturally, sporting, or politically, there have been attempts to bring it down.
The English press have always been very, very, very damaging.
How we suffered, the amount of pressure that the English press used to put us on.
I loathe it. I think this cricket is rubbish. What you're doing is you're staging a human coconut shy.
Some of the players thought their level of criticism was racial.
Because they couldn't get to you, color was always the next thing.
I don't suppose they expected the success to have gone on so long. They just thought that they'll fall soon. Yeah, a couple of years and then they'll be back where we know them to be.
They wanted the old style West Indies of entertaining and losing. When that changed, a lot of people didn't like that idea.
This is the body armor required against the West Indies. Self-preservation is the name of the game.
We were never given credit. We were always being looked upon as though our success was mainly through intimidation.
Those sort of things will make me lose my cool. People who didn't have the fast bowlers were the ones who were critical.
Let no one fool you. Everyone wanted to have fast bowlers the way we did. Everyone. There was jealousy. It went to the very top.
The English people in authority started to restrict the West Indies. Different rules and limitations on how you can bowl the ball. It was just too much.
They did everything to stifle the success of West Indies cricket. And they always thought that they would kill us.
Going to England, 1984, we wanted to send a message that when we are hurt, we'll come out fighting.
The drive against England, it was a matter of making sure that what we started, we were going to finish. Can we do it again? Let's go there and prove that the first one wasn't a fake.
the great occasion of the summer, England and the West Indies. Two teams locked in battle.
A very, very important stand this for England.
England had very good players during that period. Some of the best in the world.
And some fiery exchanges out there.
They could compete. So much immense pressure.
The English were saying that this is the best chance to beat us.
It was a who draw first blood situation.
Great shot. An excellent start by England. And Botham breaks through. Lovely display of aggression. And Alan Lamb goes to a century.
That test match at Lord's, they're in the ascendancy.
The West Indies deep in trouble now.
I can remember wondering to myself, are we going to win this game?
Facing the fire. It was pressure for me. Is today going to be my day? All these things you would have gone through, those years of hurt, now have to be put in focus.
An extraordinary stroke. And that went off like a rocket. The West Indian spectators are delirious.
When Gordon at his best, I tell you, it's brilliant to watch. And that day at Lawrence, you know, he just looked unstoppable.
He was just in awesome form, flying it to all parts of the ground. I applauded him all the way back to the pavilion.
214 not out, and what seemed to be an almost impossible assignment has turned out to be an absolute double.
And I think that was a defining moment. We felt that we could come from the brink regardless of whatever.
We were now fighters. We didn't know when we were beaten. Nothing was too daunting for us.
And out of that spirit emerged this youngster called Malcolm Marshall.
Once Malcolm Marshall went out, you knew that he was going to produce.
Marshall strikes again.
Malcolm was a guy who just exuded this sort of brilliance.
The future of the ball and attack was always there. That was Malcolm.
Malcolm Marshall bearing a double fracture.
He broke his arm. It was in plaster. I said, "You think you can play with that?" He said, "Well, if you want me to, I will."
To see him come out with one arm in a plaster, Paris, I think made him a giant of a man, really.
Here was a guy who was in excruciating pain, running up to ball at speed of light, went out and bat, and won the game for us. That showed the spirit of our team.
The statement made, you know, just very, very powerful.
He didn't need glasses to believe this.
It's not just the man out in the field bowling the ball and trying to get the opponent. It's the man watching the radio who says, "We're going to bowl him now. We have to get him now." And I've seen this happening.
Them pump him in them belly and it turn to jelly them.
Boy, what is that,
that's the genuine bouncer.
Gone.
But it tough like a
lip. Oh, is that?
Then it started.
For a dull moment out there.
Seeing the stump fly, feeling like a game going over stump.
That was top faster.
Big knives in the place, man. You know, they get what they want.
No fun, I can tell you, for any England batsman.
That's the kind of unification, that's the kind of willpower that the people develop.
And crash, and dead.
You were just seeing something totally brutal, and all what it needed was the finishing touches.
At the end of four test matches, we were 4-0 up. We could have taken the foot off the gas. We never played cricket like that, not the team I played for anyway.
Don't let them fool you.
We were humiliating them. We were really making them grovel by their not being allowed to win even one test.
Or even try to school you.
There was this feeling that we could be looking at 5-0.
The vibes start.
Ains has gone mad.
And you run down, sir, again. West is flagging, you run down, sir.
People went crazy. You're talking a tremendous amount of energy.
I could imagine the noise in the various islands. I could see the passion, how people felt.
Bosnians are delighted. Botham's gone.
All these guys had a very special message. I think we are an equal power in here.
Babylon, it's not a place. It's a practice that is unrighteous. Me not rating you because of your color, not treating each other as human beings, that is Babylon.
The English had difficulty in recognizing what West Indians had done with cricket. But guess what? I think they came to like it. This was going to change the game forever, and it was going to bring value. That is what you call cultural exchange in its finest sense.
Live for yourself, you live in vain. Live for others, you live again. One love.
They were part of us. Whatever we did, whatever we achieved, we brought a lot of songs to the people who were struggling.
When we defeated England, beating them every test of the series, represented a total reversal of our humiliation and our full flowering as a cricketing power. Even in changing it from whitewash and calling it now blackwash. Black is beautiful. Black is pride.
That, to me, epitomized everything that we represented. You know, bravery, wanting to succeed, a true West Indian feeling.
There was a lot that we had to overcome. We did not complain, and here we are, one of the greatest sporting teams in the history of team sports.
To be around people who you had an enormous amount of respect for, and to be able to have done that with them was special, yeah.
All right, let me cut it short. It was like slave whipping the asses of masters.
These are rare moments in one's life, especially with the struggles that one would have been through. It is history that you'll never forget.
That's what it was.
You know what? I'll just state a few facts. There's a fact, an undisputed fact, that between February, March of 1980 and February, March of 1995, the West Indies did not lose a test series. 15 years, they did not lose a test series. And no other sporting team in any discipline anywhere in the world dominated their sport for 15 years, and we are very proud of that.
New rivers to cross.